listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos, Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents Fail Well, the sermon by the Reverend Gene Randall Bodman, presented on Sunday, July 8th, 2018.
I've been thinking a lot about success and failure lately. As you know, I'm a bit of a news junkie, as I suspect many of us are in these days. And last week, as I pulled myself away from the internet one day, I had that familiar heavy feeling in my chest, which I sometimes name as resignation, or dread, or anxiety. But I realized that swirled in there with those other feelings was the hot, sticky sensation of shame. Now, this makes no sense at first blush, because I was not, of course, being reported on in any of those stories. They had nothing to do with me personally. Still, the constant and minute examination of every person and every move they make, this examination to find fault and to assign blame and label failure, left me in a sticky morass which most definitely felt like shame. So I've been wondering a lot about how we as a culture think about success and failure, and how we shame people, how we talk about failure, how we talk about success, how we incorporate those into our experience of being human together, and how we value other people when they experience success or failure. Now, I know I seem to mention it a lot now that it's summer, but I do love to kayak. And I've been paddling for years. But the very first time I got to get in a kayak, David and I went on a guided tour around Salt Island in Machias Bay in Maine. Now, for those of you who don't know the geography of down east Maine, Machias Bay is just southwest of the Canadian Bay of Fundy, which has the highest tidal range in the entire world, which means that even when water appears calm, it is moving with tides that rise 25, 35, or 50 feet. I didn't know very much about the Maine waterways at that point, which is probably why I got in the boat in the first place. But what I do remember with great clarity is that after we had been sized up for our life jackets and shown how to put on our spray skirts, before we even sat in our boats for the first time, before we picked up a paddle, we were instructed in the fine art of self-rescue in case we capsized. Now, for those of you who have never seen these items, a spray skirt, they come in several styles. Some of them have suspenders. Some of them you pull on up to your waist. But all of them have a drape of waterproof material that you pull out from your body and put on a ridge around you in the cockpit of the boat. If you are a person with stiffish joints or a propensity towards claustrophobia, it can seem like a bit of a trap, being stuck in a small boat with a small opening that has now been closed off, which is why they teach you how to get out of it before you even get into it physically for the first time. The goal of a paddling tour, of course, is not to capsize your very small craft when caught in the wind and the waves. But the very first thing we learned was what to do if we failed. Step one, learn to fail well. For the record, I rehearse these steps every time I get into my kayak. I've missed the mark a time or two when lowering myself into the boat from the dock, but I have never yet capsized when out on the open water. Just knowing how to fail at staying upright makes it easier for me to succeed at staying upright. Today's gospel reading also speaks of human failure. Jesus had returned to Nazareth, his small hometown, after a successful tour of teaching, healing, and exercising power. He's calmed the sea, cast demons out of a man possessed and raving, and brought him back to wholeness. He has responded with healing power to those who reached out with faith and desperation, the woman with the 12-year hemorrhage, and the 12-year-old whose illness had tipped over into death itself, so that some thought it wasn't even worth his while to go to her. And yet he did, and he woke her from a sleep close to death and raised her up, well and whole. And now, after all that, he's home. One might expect, Jesus might have expected, that when he went to the synagogue and took his place in the front to teach, that hometown crowd would be especially excited to hear him. Proud, ready to receive what the rumors told them he had been sharing all around Galilee, even across the Great Lake, over in the communities where Gentiles outnumbered Jews. Clearly, this was a person of real power. But at home, he could do nothing except a few cures. What happened? This disbelief or unfaith or lack of trust incapacitated him. As Barbara Brown Taylor put it, it incapacitated them, the people of Nazareth, the disbelievers who took offense at him. He did not change. He stayed who he was while he was in their presence. He still had the power to share with them, only he could not do anything with it because they would not let him. If you have ever pressed a lit match to a pile of wet sticks, then you know what that is like. If you've been camping in cold and wet and desperate, and the wood is also wet, and it will not light, it doesn't catch no matter how strong the flame. What you need is something that will catch fire. It was just like that with Jesus' power in his hometown. There were very few who were willing to receive it, and so he couldn't do much. Barbara Brown Taylor calls this an unmiracle story, in which Jesus held the match until it burned out in his hand, while his family and friends sat shaking their heads in discouragement and unbelief. I wonder how that felt for Jesus, after all that recent success, to come home to the people who knew him best, his own mother and brothers and sisters, the people of that small town who watched him grow up, whose children he'd played with as a child. People who had taught him, nurtured him, sought out his services as a woodworker once he was grown. He went home to them and failed. It didn't feel like failure immediately. They welcomed him, turned out to the synagogue to hear what he might have to say. Mark doesn't record Jesus' words, only the townspeople's responses. Where did he get all of that? Is this wisdom that's been given to him? Awe and respect. And then, wait a minute, this is Jesus, Mary's son, without even the respectability of a father's name. We know him. We've got all his siblings right here. Just exactly who does he think he is anyway? So they took offense at him, and that was that. He dropped the match of his teaching, offered his power, and nothing took light in the synagogue that day. It was Jesus' first big failure, the only time in the four Gospels that Jesus was unable to do something, and the last time in Mark that he appears in a synagogue. He got the message. A prophet is without honor in his own hometown and among his own extended family, and even in his very own house. He could have blasted them back, but instead he healed the few who would accept it, shook his head in amazement at the stubbornness of the rest and went to shine his light somewhere else. I wonder if you can see yourself anywhere in this narrative. Can you imagine yourself as one of the few who caught up with Jesus after the stonewalling in the synagogue and said, "I trust you, heal me"? Do you see yourself as one of his own family members, his mother and brothers and sisters, who were chagrined at his arrogance, so much so that earlier in the gospel, they wanted him silenced because they thought he'd lost his mind? Or do you imagine yourself as one of the Nazarenes, skeptical of the power of the hometown boy returned, speaking with authority, with wisdom that he certainly didn't learn from anyone at home? I can easily imagine myself in that last category. Not offended exactly, but put out. In a former ministry, there was a boy I knew from the time he was in sixth grade. He was a bright kid, but a giant goofball. I confirmed that kid. I watched him play football. I tossed a frisbee with him after a heartbreak in high school. I laughed at his spectacularly bad puns on youth retreats. And then, like that, snap, I turned around and he came home with a master's degree in astrophysics. And he had written a thesis, the title of which I could not even pronounce, much less understand. He spoke with authority, and I was proud of him. But I also felt the ground underneath me unsettle a little bit. Here was this punk that I had taken care of. I didn't like it 100%. In a similar way, the people of Jesus' hometown are both wowed and impressed, and then they grew resentful at all that Jesus had been able to accomplish. Because really, where did he get off? Why should we listen to him? He's nobody. I wonder if there are people speaking outside the accepted channels of power in our own day whose voices we cannot hear, at whom we take offense, because who do they think they are anyway? And I wonder if we are called to speak with God-given power, but silence our own voices, because who do we think we are to give voice to what we've experienced? Jesus showed his disciples how to handle failure, how to be ready to be capsized. He called the 12 to him, gave them authority, and sent them out. He sent them two by two for protection and for a witness. And he told them, travel light. Wear sandals to protect your feet and carry a staff to help you walk and ward off animals. But nothing else. No bread, no bag, no money in your belt. Don't even try to get slick and pack an extra tunic by wearing it. Just go in the clothes you are standing up in. Be dependent on the hospitality of others. When you get to a new town or village, stay at the first place that will welcome you. And don't look to trade up when things start to go well and someone with a nicer house and more generous portions at the dinner table invites you over. And most of all, if you get to a place that refuses to hear you, if you fail to make a connection, get on out of there. Don't even take the dust of that place with you as you go on your way to the next place. This is how you fail. Go on. Now, I'm not suggesting that in our success-driven culture, we should not evaluate performances and look for growing edges and maximize results. But really, I think we get more than enough of that message. We have more than enough impulse for self-assessment. These things are valuable, but not always. My husband, David, and I have two sons. They're both young adults now. The younger just recently graduated from high school. So my days as a sports mom are well and truly over. We only have the two kids, but they're 7.5 years apart. So that equals quite a few years of sitting on the sidelines and in stands cheering. 20 years, to be exact. Then, when you add in the church youth whose plays and concerts and games I've attended, well, that is a lot of cheering on I've had the chance to do. And all that watching and cheering of teams gave me a front row seat to the strategies different kids adopted to learning, trying, succeeding, and failing. One boy who I watched over the years, who may or may not have the same last name as mine, was such a cooperative, non-competitive soccer player as a little boy that he would watch the trajectory of the ball and run to meet it, but if an opponent got there first, he would step back to be polite. The coaches put him in the goal, which he more or less enjoyed. Then, in sixth grade, a friend invited him to try out for lacrosse, and they put that big stick in his hands, and everything changed. He could not get enough of it. He loved it. He'd go to practice, eat dinner, and then go back out to play some more. He read about it. He watched it. He played it. He carried his lacrosse stick literally everywhere. And in short order, he was very, very good at playing lacrosse. He learned to cradle the ball in the stick, to pass, shoot, and score. He learned to scoop up ground balls, get open for a pass, and ride on defense. He learned how to help his team win. What he didn't learn was how to fail. I don't mean when the whole team lost. Then he was about as patient and gracious as most adolescent boys, so spotty. I mean that when he made a mistake, when he missed a shot or threw a wide pass or let a defensive player get by him without throwing at least one good check, he'd become incensed with himself. He'd pull himself out of the flow of the game to mentally and sometimes verbally berate himself. One day, we parents were sitting right behind the players' bench, and this boy missed a pass. It's a pretty easy pass, and he just missed it. He pulled up and he slammed his stick into the ground before he turned and returned to the game. The coach called him out and said, "What just happened? What were you thinking?" The poor kid, in an agony of self-recrimination, said, "I know, coach. I missed the pass." And the coach said to him, "Get that thought out of your head. The ball was on the ground. That's what you should be thinking. Oh, look, a ground ball. That's mine. The missed pass is over. The ground ball is ahead. Go get it." Another time, that same coach called that same boy, who was my son, out of the game and grabbed him by the helmet and said, "It's enough. Have some fun." In a similar way, Jesus said to his disciples, and through them to us, "If you get to a place and the people won't hear you, move on and continue your work with someone ready to hear you. Don't hold on to places that won't receive you. Don't take their doubt or anger or fear, their bitterness or scorn with you. Shake it off and move forward." During this period of our national life, when public discourse has become so divided, there are calls for people of goodwill to stay in dialogue, to listen to everyone, to be open to hearing the voices of people with whom we disagree the most. And I agree, except when the condition of staying in ongoing dialogue is agreeing to continue in a debased position. If your dialogue partner cannot hear you as equal, cannot see you as a full human being, if the conversation fails in that way and keeps you oppressed, move on. Don't give up hope. Don't go back home and give up working for justice. but don't keep focusing on what has not worked. Move on and engage in the next conversation. It may be that the person you left behind will hear you once you are gone and they feel less threatened. It may be that they will overhear your next conversation and become convinced. It may be that the rising tide of public opinion will shift them and help them. It's important that people who are being oppressed are not told, you must stand there with your oppressor and be in dialogue. People of color are not required to continue in conversation with racist white people. That's other white people's work. Women are not required to try to convince men who harass women that harassment is wrong. That's other men's job. We are not called to be mired in the dust of the people who will not hear us. We must trust that God has not given up on them. We are called to tell the world what we have experienced and received, to go simply, looking for places where we will be heard, to use whatever power God has given us, and when we fail to connect, to leave behind whatever disappointment, shame, or bitterness we've encountered. To paraphrase the words of Congressman John Lewis, do not get lost in a sea of despair. Be hopeful. The truth of the gospel is not the work of a day, a week, a month, or a year. It is the work of a lifetime. Never, ever be afraid to make some noise and get in good trouble. Necessary trouble. For the sake of justice, for the sake of love, for the sake of the realm of God. We are called to be like Jesus, using every gift God gave us, failing well, and moving on to work again. Amen.
Listen.